In this month's edition of Midday on Culture with Sherry Parks, a conversation about changing regional cultures and identity. The more global our culture, the more mobile people become, the more regional identities fade away. Is Baltimore losing its accent and its original character? Is Balmer a thing of the past? What stops a local culture from being lost? And going forward, how might the identity of the city change? Globalization, gentrification, homogenization, preserving regional identity, and the distinctive accent in a rapidly changing world. Midday on Culture with Sherry Parks, after the news from NPR. Welcome back to Midday, everyone. Dan Rodericks here. Thanks again for joining us for the second hour today. A few times during the last year, I've heard people say they don't hear the Baltimore accent as much as they used to. This is a very distinctive accent that is widely, affectionately, and playfully mimicked by people who didn't grow up here with it, and some who did. It's part of the unique Balmer character, you know, when you hear it. And when it comes to whatever that is, the original Balmer character, I think you know when you are in its presence. It got me to wondering if the Balmer accent is fading, and there could be a few dozen reasons for that, is what makes Baltimore unique fading? And I don't mean buildings or institutions. I mean something less tangible, but something very real, that thing that makes the region unique. In fact, a lot of people, preservationist professional, preservationist casual, and preservationist freelance, have been acutely aware of the changes that little by little, or in grand strokes, change the character of a place. The more global our culture, the more mobile people become, the more regional identities fade away. Is Baltimore losing its accent and its original character? Now, globalization is one thing. There's another phenomenon that has been described, and I think perfectly, as the homogenization of the provinces. It's what happens to communities when their local character and culture become neutralized by pop culture, mass communication, and the franchising of institutions, small and large. Without efforts to preserve and celebrate the local culture, you know, we're up against McDonald's, Disney, and the omnipresent force of television, now the internet and social media. Each town and each city ultimately could lose its identity. Years ago, there was a columnist in the city paper, Arnold Zwy, Z-W-Y, Arnold Zwy. He once remarked that he loved Baltimore because it wasn't Washington, it wasn't New York. And Arnold Zwy appreciated that within this region, there was enough cultural diversity to satisfy most anyone who enjoys life in a land of unpredictable and unpretentious delights. You remember the controversy just a couple of years ago when the owner of Cafe Hun wanted to trademark the term Hun? There was an uproar about it. We discussed it here on Midday. And during that time, we reflected on just what the term meant to people around here. A term of endearment. Hun is something that makes Baltimore a bit different from every place else, USA. Now, it might not be part of everyone's greeting. There's a history around here of African Americans and feminists finding it offensive. But it was poured into the pot a long time ago and survives as a provincialism that distinguishes this city and the communities adjoining it from all the other metropolitan areas. I mean, you can hear you want fries with that anywhere in the United States. Only in and near Baltimore do you hear you want fries with that Hun. Now, like it or not, so Hun is part of this community's tradition and culture as much as I could list a few other things. Snow panic in winter, bull roast in the spring, snowball stands, produce trucks in the summer, A-rabbers, streets filled with kids and new clothes and shoes at Easter, marble steps, painted tires filled with petunias, the pride we feel for Brooks Robinson and Frank Robinson. We thought we'd talk about this today with Sherry Parks, culture critic. This has been something that's been on my mind for a while, and I thought Sherry's coming in again here in May for her usual hour with us to talk about pop culture. So I thought we would talk about this today. Midday commentator, author, and associate dean in arts and humanities at the University of Maryland College Park. Sherry, thanks for coming in. How you doing?
Thanks for having me. I'm doing okay.
So that's sort of my setup here. We discussed this a couple of times about bringing up on the air here. And it all started with that conversation I had I've had a few times when people say, you know, I don't hear that Balmer accent as much as I used to. I hear people imitate it, people who didn't grow up here like myself or like you, but I don't hear it as much. And like I said, there's many reasons for that. It could be just who you're coming into contact with and where you are. But I wonder, you know, as time goes by, the world becomes a big global place, globalization, suburbanization, all changes occur. We lose some of what was, you know, sort of baked into the crust a long time ago.
Well, and you brought up, I think, a lot of good points. And you and I are both transplants. We should
right.
say that.
Mm-hmm.
That what's really important, neither of us went to high school here.
Right, I know. That's another very distinct Balmer thing.
Right.
Like, what school did you go to? And they're talking about high school, right?
But our children did. Mm-hmm. And I've lived here longer than I've lived anywhere else.
Same
and
here.
So, mm-hmm. I mean, so some really pivotal life events have happened here. And I chose Baltimore. I came to Maryland because of the job at the University of Maryland. But I lived somewhere else in the state for a year and then said, I need to find a place that has a sense of itself, a place that has a sense of history, a sense of a place.
Oh, and I see. So the first place you landed, you didn't have that sense, huh?
It was anywhere and nowhere. And, you know, it had been made with a backhoe. And there are lots of places like that.
Mm-hmm.
And I had never lived in a place like that and didn't like it. And I looked around and Baltimore has a... And particularly then, this was a little bit more than 20 years ago, had a real sense of itself. And so I chose it. But of course, then I become part of the change because I did not move into Ashburton, which is where I was told I was supposed to move.
Right.
And so I'm part of the change because I immediately started acting differently. And I think I do want to set up so people have something to hang on to in terms of the analysis, because when we're talking about cultural change, certainly there's the land, I mean, that's there, and the water, and that's a big part of Baltimore culture. But then you have the built environment. But what really we're talking about is what happens with the people, with their minds and their bodies and their behavior and their rituals and language and speech. And then when you talk about imitation of language, it's not really imitation in the sincere sense. It's parody. Is parody preservation? If the only people for instance, you brought up Hun culture.
Yeah, we can bring up Hun Fest,
right?
Which
right.
is a parody of what? White women of the 1940s, 50s, 60s.
Who didn't live in Hamden.
Right.
Someone had to tell
me. May have lived in Hamden.
Well,
maybe.
Someone who has had several generations here, mm-hmm. said the center for Hun culture was Sparrows Point.
Okay, down it, southeast side.
It,
of the
it
city.
Wasn't right. Hun culture. And so she sees the Hun culture in Hamden as an imitation
right.
of the core.
Now, and some people take offense. Does she take offense to it?
She takes offense up.
Mm-hmm.
And she's middle class and white, but she grew up here. And what it doesn't preserve is the strength of those women. I mean, they become their hair and the glasses and the
right.
talk. But
right.
you're talking about strong working class white women who held their families together through some adversity.
Yeah.
And so what gets preserved and what doesn't, I think, is part of the conversation we need to have.
Well, we could talk about Hun Fest. It's a month away. It's in June, usually held in the June of the year. And some people have grown tired of it and said, you know, this is parody of a bygone Baltimore, and I don't get what you're doing here. Others see it as just another reason to have some fun and to celebrate a nostalgic aspect of Baltimore life.
Well, and is it its own type of preservation? I'm actually dancing on both sides of this aisle here, that without the Hun Fest, would we be talking about Huns at all?
That's true. And would you talk to people? How do you talk to people from out of town about Baltimore? I mean, what are the things you mention? You probably mention Hun Fest, or you post a photograph on Facebook, or send a photograph to a friend from it saying, this is a pretty cool thing. Next time you come to Baltimore, come in June and go to this thing. You'll enjoy
well,
it.
Well,
right?
See, I talk about, because I move up and down between College Park and here, mm-hmm. I talk about Baltimore a lot because I get the question at least once a week, why don't you live closer to the university? And so I have to talk about why my family's life is here.
Right.
And I don't talk about Hun Fest. I talk about the sense of humor and the warmth and the sense of place.
Mm-hmm.
There's a very quirky sense
too.
Of humor.
Yeah.
And I tell a story how when my daughter Kelsey, she's over 18 now, so I'll say her name in the air, we were at an Orioles game. And she was a toddler, but she was in my arms, and we stood up for a home run. And there had been two elderly gentlemen behind us who were kind of flirting with her. And when we sat down, she had a nacho in her hand. And in Baltimore, I let her eat it. Because
they gave her a nacho.
They gave her a nacho. Yeah.
Someplace else you might not have done
right,
that.
Right, because when I looked around at them, they looked down like, we didn't do that, lady. But yeah. I mean, it was a joke, but it was Baltimore, and it was warm, and it was familiar, and I knew she was okay. And people in other cities have said, you let her eat it?
Yeah, I know. I felt the same way about Baltimore when I got here in the 70s. You know, once I got over the language barrier,
yeah.
once people could understand me and I could understand them, because I moved down here with a really thick New England accent.
Which you still have.
I still
hear that.
People tell me they still hear it. But I had trouble with the Balmer accent, really did. It took me a while to adjust to that. But then I realized this is part of the city. The city has its own accent, practically its own dialect.
And I don't have, quote, an accent, although somebody in Baltimore walked up to me and said, I just need to know whether it's Presbyterian or Episcopalian. You're African-American, middle class. Your parents were teachers, probably from North Carolina.
Wow.
He read me correctly.
Wow. How do you like that? 410-662-8780 is our phone number here. And I guess the question I should ask is, do you feel like the original Baltimore character, whatever that is, however you defined it, is wearing off, fading away? When I talk about globalization, right, that everything is everywhere. I use the example of restaurants, for instance. There's chain restaurants. Every place you go, you see the same thing. And I think what people want to hold on to, what makes them feel like they're at home again, right, is the thing that isn't a chain, that the thing that is unique about a city. There was only one Hausner's once upon a time. Of course, that's gone. There's only one Fadley's in Lexington Market. Things like that you kind of cling to and hope will be there forever, because you need those anchors, those iconic anchors.
Well, food is really, really important. And how the food, I mean, one of the ways I feel it is, I guess I can say this on the air, I'm allergic to something that's in Old Bay. I wasn't allergic to Y River and other brands, but now that Old Bay is very ubiquitous. And so I feel it, because I'll say that to people and they'll treat it as a disability.
Mm.
I mean, they try to fix it. They'll say, right.
but wait, can you do this? You have to appreciate Old Bay, right?
I mean, it's not that I don't appreciate it. It's delicious. I just, you know, will break out in hives.
Right.
There's something in it. And so there is that food tradition, but how often do we eat that anymore?
I would like to know from folks. That's a good question. 410-662-8780 is our number here. And then there are other people, I'm sure, Sherry, who just work very hard at keeping every aspect of their life as Balmer as possible, right? So we'd like to hear from you, too, if you'd like to join our conversation here. And there, I've heard from some people who have always found that the accent, the Balmer accent, a kind of a low-class sounding, not very professional. They're glad to see it go. They're glad to see it sort of bleed out of the fade away from our area here.
That is an interesting question, because Baltimore culture is a working class culture, and African American scholars have had to deal with the same thing. What's left of the culture once you take away economic deprivation? And I think that really is an important part of how we feel about Baltimore.
I want to hear more about that. We'll take a little break here. We'll come back and continue our conversation with Sherry Parks. 410-662-8780 if you'd like to join us. Welcome back to Midday. Sherry, speaking of food, before we return to the subject that you were just talking about before the break, there's something I wrote once in The Sun. I pulled this out. I haven't read this in years, so I'm just going to read it cold. But I do remember making these comments about my travels and the food I was eating during a particular time in my life when I was spending a lot of time in a van traveling up and down the East Coast. I said, the rule of the day is everything everywhere the same. I believe that has become the dominant aesthetic in America. Mass consumerism, homogenized and repeated endlessly from sea to shining sea. The vision of the familia has always been comforting. Once upon a time, the familia was a corner cafe in a small town, a diner out on the edge of town, a hardware store downtown, the great good places that provided products, service, and a sense of community in a small town or a city neighborhood. Now the familia is a strip mall anchored by retail stores that we all know from mass market advertising. What the chain restaurants sell, the same meal in Pennsylvania as in New Hampshire, is now fully ingrained as American comfort food. And I think that's true. So you have to be a little bit daring these days to go, if you're a tourist, if you're traveling someplace, to go someplace that's not familiar.
Yeah, because
right?
you take the risk that you're not going to like it. I mean, that's when it is your neighborhood restaurants, whatever, you know what's there is familiar. And but now, particularly if you're traveling with young people, what they're familiar with is the sameness. The sameness is the same in Korea. Right. You know, McDonald's is McDonald's.
This
is McDonald's.
The part I've never understood. Like, if you go to Baltimore, if you're traveling here, you want to at least try crabs, right? That's what people say. You got to have a crab cake. You got to... Or go try some oysters or something like that, right? Is that, this is what we tell them. Then there are people who say, no, take me to Denny's.
Well,
right? No, I'm not exaggerating
no,
either.
No.
Especially
and,
when
and,
it comes
and,
to teenagers.
Yeah, you're right. You're not exaggerating. And so that what is lost, that there's something in the middle that's lost, this valuing of something that's not the sameness. I mean, sameness used not to be a good thing. And now that continuity is the thing that people want.
So you kind of agree with
me? I very much agree with you.
I think the man who developed the White Tower restaurant or White Castle had this idea that there would be uniformity, that he would serve the same size hamburger made the same way each city. So that when you traveled, you stepped out of a subway or out of a train station, you saw the White Tower, you know what to expect there.
Right.
And that's, I guess, the secret of McDonald's and all the other fast food places.
What you're suggesting, and this is really interesting, is that our concept of home has changed. Because if White Castle is home, if McDonald's is home, then it's not our home. It's everybody's
Tuesdays,
home.
Right,
I mean, you can argue that this is the way to build a nation instead of, I mean, you know, there have been several books I talked about as being 5, 6, 8 different nations. And so there's maybe a benefit, although I don't see a real benefit to that.
Hey, before I go to the phone line, start taking some calls and hearing from our listeners, Sherry Parks, you were talking about economic deprivation or... I don't say the loss of it or moving away from economic deprivation.
Oh, it's the phrase loss of economic deprivation. Yeah, Baltimore at its core culture is a working class culture. And there are lots of rituals and attitudes and behaviors that are tied to having less money than we were talking during the break about crabs, which everybody will admit is Baltimore. I mean, everybody talks about Maryland crab cakes. You can buy, quote, Maryland crab cakes in California and New York. And I always put them in, I'm doing air quotes.
Air quotes.
You know, because breading is not in there, shouldn't be in there that much. But really, when you think about crabbing, there's this whole ritual to it. It was cheap because you could go and get the crabs.
You mean catch them yourself?
Catch them yourself, and then you brought them home and you cooked them yourself, and then you sat around all afternoon. It was entertainment. It took all afternoon, and you ate a lot of things around it that were inexpensively produced, and that was the fun. And I've actually found myself, kind of the interloper, explaining that to people. That is, you don't eat crabs to get full. That's not the point. The point is to pick them, not to beat them with those mallets.
Right.
Pick a tourist.
It's a form of socializing,
right? You can always pick out the tourist who's beating them with the mallet, and gradually, talk and you tell stories, and that's the point. So that's
I love that. The first time I did that, it was we were watching an Orioles game on a big screen in a crab house, and we watched the whole game and went through a couple of dozen crabs.
Right, but it's not a very expensive, especially if you're doing it the way the old people did it. It's not an expensive thing. It's tied to needing to find something that didn't cost a lot of money.
Right. I go to the Inner Harbor. There's another comment about what I see at the Inner Harbor. A lot of folks say, well, Baltimore, Inner Harbor, you got to go and visit the Inner Harbor. But actually, we don't have at the Inner Harbor, now that Phillips has moved, really a local anchor restaurant or store there that I can think of. I'm sorry if I offend anybody if there's something I'm forgetting. But, there's a Bubba Gump is down there, and Ripley's is down there, right? That's what you see at the Inner Harbor. Not that there's anything wrong with that. It's just that it's not what I want to see. If I come to Baltimore, I want to see, Gertrude's, John Shields' place, or, Donna's or something.
Well, and as
local,
you can just go a couple of blocks and you find it, but you, if you're a tourist, you can't find it, and that's the point. Who are they catering to?
Right. 410-662-8780. So I guess I should ask, what do you cling to? And do you care about this? What do you cling to make Baltimore feel like home to you, to always feel like Baltimore to you? There's some traditions, the things that you count on from seeing from year to year, the Flower Mart, for instance, in Baltimore, the lemon peppermint sticks that people, I'd love to go out of state to visit relatives or friends and bring these the makings of lemon.
I sent peppermint sticks to my daughter in college.
They love you forever. It's just a small thing. You got to find the right peppermint stick.
Soft
one.
Porous.
Yeah. They'll love you forever. You introduce them to lemon peppermint sticks from Baltimore. All right, we'll start taking some calls here. Gene in Ellicott City, thank you for calling Midday with Dan and Sherry Parks here.
Hi. You were talking about homogenization earlier, and I guess I think I've lost most of my Baltimore accent a long time ago, but I grew up in Dundalk and I was going to high school with Mount St. Joe, so that was where part of my I had to get rid of some of my Dundalk accent just to get through high school because you got all this you're from Dundalk? What do you mean Dundalk?
Yeah.
I don't know where
Dundalk
that is.
Dundalk jokes, right? Dundalk jokes. But did they give you a hard time over your accent?
Well, yeah, not so much the Baltimore part of it, but just the especially the Dundalk part of it. And then after I graduated from St. Joe, I went to University of Maryland College Park. And then at that point in time, I'm mid-50s, early 60s person. Down in College Park, you had a lot of commuters and from Montgomery County at that point in time. And you got all the crap about I'm sorry, but
it's all right. About what, though?
You got all this stuff from them about Baltimore being the armpit of the nation, and mm-hmm. So you had to sort of get rid of the rest of your Baltimore accent to sort of slide through as far in social situations sometimes. So,
well, Gene, that's very interesting. So you're saying you felt pressured to kind of shed whatever accent you had because it to the ears of strangers, it sounded like what? It sounded like Balmer? It sounded like Dundalk?
Everybody, sort of look, now I think Baltimore has shed the image of being sort of backward, and, I think for a long time we were really, Baltimore didn't have a real good image of itself, so mm-hmm. You sort of, when you were out in other worlds, you sort of you minimized things until you could talk. Once you got to know people, then you could talk to them about all the great things around here.
Right, but, Gene, that's very interesting. Yeah. I appreciate you calling.
He shed it because he wanted to be mobile. We think about it in terms of upwardly mobile, but he wanted to be geographically mobile. And it's interesting, the statement about College Park, because it has shifted since, not because I've been there, but while I've been there, the attitude about Baltimore. But now it's interesting. I had a student who actually did her senior thesis on this. There's a College Park look. There's a most universities have their own look. But the one group of people who stand out who don't adopt the College Park look is people from Baltimore.
Really?
So that you can almost pick out, and I've done it. I've walked up to people and said, "You're from Baltimore."
Really?
And they said, "Yes."
Can you describe it?
It's more bohemian. Wow. It's more eccentric. Mm-hmm. They're brighter colors.
Interesting. What I was going to say about the idea of shedding your accent so people will accept you more, that's a very sensitive subject, and that goes on all over the country in different places.
Yeah, the accent that can go everywhere.
Yeah, that's the one I guess you want, and you hear it more and more. You hear it on radio, you hear it on television. After the years go by, the local accent, wherever we're talking about, Baltimore, New England, the South, the Southwest, really rings out in your ear, doesn't it?
And I think that's why I'm sensitive to it, because I was made not to have an accent. I mean, being the daughter of two school teachers, growing up in Western North Carolina, there were accents. There was a black one, there was a white one. We lived in an integrated neighborhood. And my mother said, "No, you cannot speak that way, because we can't afford for you to speak that way." And so And when I was at Chapel Hill, they actually had a class where they would deregionalize your voice. I was the first African-American not to be made to take that class because I was going to write a story about it, maybe. But my point is, you lose something when you give away your accent.
Right. 410-662-8780. Sean in Highlandtown. Thanks for calling, Sean.
All right. Thank you very much. I moved up here from Georgia. My grandfather is from Baltimore. He's from Fells Point. I'm a doctor of pharmacy. I've traveled all over the Southeast. I've lived in many cities. and I've traveled the world. And I chose to live in Baltimore because it's organic, it's real, the people are good. This is a very special place. I've been all over, and I just don't understand why people in Maryland don't appreciate what's in Baltimore. It's such a unique place with unique culture. I finally bought myself a row house, and this summer I'm going to be out there scrubbing those steps.
Way to go, Sean. Thank you very much for calling in. Well, I think there has been an appreciation of Baltimore in the last 30 years. Baltimore started calling itself Charm City sometime, I don't know when that was, in the 60s or 70s, part of a public relations campaign in the days of William Donald Schaefer when he was mayor. And I'll never forget this, Sherry. In 1975, Baltimore was the cover story or a major story in National Geographic magazine. I've never forgotten that.
An exotic place?
As a place that's underappreciated, that an industrial port city. And, if you drove on 95, that's what people's view of Baltimore would be, on 95 Harbor Tunnel or something. And you'd look over and you'd see what looked like industry. And it was Bethlehem Steel down the point and all the points between there and the Inner Harbor. And this writer in the National Geographic, I never forget that he said that was just sort of the tattered overcoat on a really charming city. And then he explored all the, oddities about Baltimore, the peculiarities of it, including our mayor.
And we should dig into that a little, because Baltimore is now a post-industrial city. So the labor is part of the heart of a city, and a lot of that is gone. And so the question we're asking is, can we keep what was built around that labor when we don't have that labor anymore?
All right. And that's where a lot of this came from, emanated from here.
Yes.
A couple of emails to read. Michelle says, since moving to Maryland some 20 plus years ago, it is a tradition with our family to have at least one summer day, usually around my son's birthday, to have family over and eat crabs with Old Bay, corn on the cob, potato salad. When I have guests from out of town, I generally treat them to crab cakes and a visit to Baltimore. This email is from Frank, responding to my question, what for him makes Balmer Balmer? And he says, he writes it there, Balmer Balmer. Little Italy's St. Anthony Festival, Little Italy's St. Antony Festival, Arabers selling watermelon, red to the rind, selling flowers on Harrod Street. Frank wrote that in the Balmer accent. And if you want to do that, folks, you're welcome to do it. We're having a little fun with this today.
Well, but ethnic diversity actually is part of the Baltimore story. The distinct neighborhoods that are starting to dissipate is an important part, and that's where a lot of the richness comes from.
To your point about the Baltimore being industrial city, blue-collar city, and its original character, here's a comment from the Baltimore Chop. The original Baltimore character had everything to do with jobs, specifically jobs around the waterfront. Mm. Now that the neighborhoods within 2 miles of the harbor are fully and completely gentrified, and the city's base of jobs is entirely bound up with Hopkins and University of Maryland, the former heart of the inner city is nothing more than Waterfront County, a place where youngish, affluent whites live, not by necessity of being close to work, but because they want a suburban lifestyle with city convenience and water views.
Does that suggest that if we bring in working class jobs back into the city, that culture would revive around it?
Just
a question.
You mean like a manufacturing revival?
Or something that brings working class people back to the heart of the city.
Is that the origins of the character we're talking about here?
Well, it is the origins of the character, and I'm just asking what's maybe a rhetorical, but maybe not a rhetorical question about how would we change that?
Listen to more of this here. Maybe someone wants to try to answer your question, but this is interesting for Baltimore Chop. To add insult to injury, many gentrifying projects like Silo Point and Tie Point pay lip service to some idea of Baltimore identity and, quotes, history and sense of self, but do little more than fetishize blue-collar culture while trying to remain as insulated from it as possible. Well, you like that comment?
Well, yeah.
That's pretty edgy.
We were talking about parody, but fetishization is
Hunfest.
A type of...
I think John Waters said that he'd had it with the Hunfest a couple of years ago. Basically, if it wasn't... And John Waters contributed a lot to that, right?
Yes, he did.
To that part of it. Tim says that, I don't think anything is disappearing as much as things are changing, and it's hard to make sense of it without great consideration of race. Baltimore is, after all, a majority black city. I'm black, and I can't really think of any black people who say Hun or Blair or Balmer, etc. Maybe the Baltimore accent is just poorly named. Go to social media and search DMV accent or slang. I've lived around the northern part of the tri-state area my whole life, and it still confuses me to no end, but I know people across the country who think it is very distinctive.
Han culture is also about race. I mean, there are several, actually, Baltimore accents. There's a Baltimore middle-class black accent. There's a Baltimore working-class accent. But the spirit of it is very much the same in Baltimore. Actually, it just happened to me walking to the station. You know, a working-class black man spoke to me and smiled and kept walking. Mm-hmm. I mean, that's very Baltimore.
Sherry Parks here with us. We'll take a little break and come back and take some more phone calls. Open phone lines here for our conversation about Baltimore culture, character. Is globalization making the Baltimore accent fade away, and with it some of the Baltimore character or the regional identity? 410-662-8780 is our number. The Midday email address, midday@wypr.org. We're on Twitter at @MiddayWYPR, and you can find some more information about our show on my Facebook page. Welcome back to Midday. Dan Roderick's here with Sherry Parks. That DMV that Tim referred to, accent, DMV accent, I believe he means Delmarva, right?
Yeah, it's the same thing.
Yeah, here on the Delmarva. I love Delmarva. I love that phrase, Delmarva Peninsula. Someone's probably named a daughter Delmarva by now, don't you think?
I'm sure.
Jeff says, I am from Baltimore, lived in Boston for 7 years, and moved back in 2005. Baltimore and Boston both have similar unique identities. People from D.C. who bash Baltimore are transient fools who leave every 4 years. I've lived in Fells Point, Mount Vernon, Federal Hill, and I don't plan on leaving anytime soon. I do think the Hun aspect is going away, though. I personally find it rather tiresome and outdated. Hun Fest, though, is fun and should stay around. That's from Jeff. Thank you.
One group of people from the D.C. area who love Baltimore and come up here often are the artists, because the art scene here is freer and wackier than it is in other parts of the state.
I agree with you. I've heard others express that. Sierra in Owings Mills, sort of along those lines. Hi, Sierra.
Hi. Wow, this is my first time on a radio show.
All right.
I know we've kind of moved away from what makes Baltimore Baltimore, but for me, one thing that has made Baltimore Baltimore for the past 4 years at least is KSR, the Kinetic Sculpture Race that is coming up this Saturday.
Oh, is it this weekend? Great.
Mm-hmm. My school, Genesee, participates in KSR annually. So that's how I found out about it. This will actually probably be my last year doing it, which is kind of sad, but it's a lot of fun. It's always full of energy, and of course, the Visionary Arts Museum that supports KSR, that puts on KSR every year, has been in Baltimore for a very long time, and things like the Visionary Arts Museum, the National Aquarium, the Science Center, that's what makes Baltimore home to me.
That's great.
Actually going and seeing the waterfront and all of the museums and things around the area, that's what signifies Baltimore to me.
But in particular, the Kinetic Sculpture Race and all the creativity and imagination that goes into that.
And the reason it is not parody is because it is also serious art. I mean, there's a sense of humor and it's wacky and crazy, but it's not.
People mean it. They're earnest about it.
They mean it. They're earnest about it, yes.
What about this idea of homogenization of the regions? So as I was thinking about this today, so we still have it, right? I mean, if you go to Alabama, you still hear people speak with an Alabama accent. There's regional cuisine that's still celebrated, right? And culture and music. Right?
Somewhat, yes.
Those things still exist, right? We haven't, the country has not been steamrolled into this homogenized place yet.
Well, but the same thing has happened in the, quote, New South. Underneath, the Old South is still there. But, I mean, there's this fascinating magazine that is about guns and food.
Gardens and Guns? What's that magazine called? I finally got to see it this year.
And it's upper classization of working class Southern culture. And so that's that same phenomenon of taking that working class really poor culture and fetishizing it and having your chef make it.
Right.
So you're getting that same thing over and over. So the question then, what happens with real working class culture?
Well, it's going away.
It's gardens and guns. You're right.
Gardens and guns. Is going away. Is that what's happened? There's gentrification. There's yuppification. There's, you know, what are we
so,
talking about? Class.
So,
we're talking about change in class. How
so
people work.
So do real working class people, because they're still there, are we imagining them as just aspiring to be middle class? People who aren't yet middle class?
Right.
I don't think that's true. I think they're still there.
Or are we just nostalgic about it?
Who is we in that question?
Those of us. Not me. I don't go for that sort of celebration of that you're talking about, exemplified by that magazine, Gardens and Guns.
Well, yeah, right? it's a strange magazine.
I have this joke with Italian American friends. We joke about polenta. You know, polenta was this very simple peasant food my mother would make when she didn't have anything else in the house.
Yeah.
It was cornmeal mush with some cheese on it, some tomato sauce, and made it good.
Oh, now it's very fancy.
And now it's, you know, they slice it, they grill it, and they charge you $25 for a piece of polenta and a small piece of fish or something, $35. But, you know, that's how things have changed, right?
Well, but also in part...
It's partly affluence.
It's
right?
influence. But that food tastes good, too. So, I mean, that's in some ways a partial answer to franchising, is to reach into what used to be the margins and pull that food forward.
And comforting.
Yes.
Okay. We'll go to Creighton. Creighton, thank you for calling. You're on Midday. Hi.
Hello. Yeah, what I found really valuable to me in Baltimore, I was a black boy in East Baltimore, raised in East Baltimore, was when we moved over to the west side, we lived in what is now Bolton Hill, but back then it wasn't called Bolton Hill, it was just a lot of old houses. And inevitably, the things I love the most have to change because, you know, people want better housing and better environments in their community. So the things I love the most are the old things. My father and mother used to live in a lot of different apartments, and apartments were furnished. I mean, they had sofas that you take three people to lift up. It was just heavy furniture. I just love their old furniture and old houses. I still do. And as a matter of fact, I travel through Baltimore City now with a lot of books in my car, looking at videos, or photographs of scenes. And I go to that location where I think the photographer took the picture so as to see what changed. And, you know, the other thing is about Baltimore I loved the most was Jewel Park. Everybody went, it didn't cost you a dime. You know, you could make homemade sandwiches, and everybody just went to Jewel Park, and you met all type of people out at Jewel Park. You had the Mansion House, and you go in and see
it's still there, Creighton.
Huh?
I said it's still there.
Yeah, but you know,
it's great. I saw the cherry blossoms there a couple of weeks ago.
It's still there, but it's just stuff costs more now. If you want to cook hot food, you got to pay to cook food and the barbecue stuff and things like. So it's kind of like the commercial thing just kind of took over the idea. I don't feel the same kind of like, hey, there's 10,000 kids running all over the place playing. You had the police out there riding horseback. You know, it was just a different kind of environment for me.
Okay. I thought the most important part of that...
My point is it's still there. This isn't just nostalgia.
But I thought the most important part of what he was saying when he first said it, and then he came back and said it again, was that it didn't cost you a dime.
Mm-hmm.
It was just culture. It wasn't commercialized.
Yeah, it was just there. And I don't know what he's talking about when it comes to Druid Hill Park. Is there a charge for something there? I actually don't know that. Every time I've gone there, I just walk into the place. I know there's a charge to get in the zoo. Anyway, I don't know.
I think he's also talking
there's
about
a lot of free stuff.
Maybe
still,
vendors,
free parks. I love how we all give directions based on what used to be there. Right, Susan, turn left where the Chesapeake used to be. Go past where Memorial Stadium used to be.
I'm so happy to hear her say that.
I know where the News American used to be.
I am so happy to hear her say that because I used to get lost a lot.
Right. Well, could people give directions that way?
Yeah.
Oh, that's pretty funny. Tom in Mount Vernon. Nice to hear from you, Tom.
Yes, sir. Nice to hear from you guys. And my pet peeve, Mr. Rodericks, is when people who are not necessarily from New York like yourself refer to Baltimore steps as stoops.
Mm-hmm.
I never heard anybody refer to the famous white Baltimore marble stoops.
No, not white marble stoops, but I've heard people say out on the stoop. Now, you're
right.
saying that's not a Baltimore thing?
No, I looked in the dictionary. Stoop is actually a Dutch word, which makes sense because New Amsterdam was, you know, New York was New Amsterdam. So stoop makes sense for there, which it means step up.
Tom, I'll put it out to our listeners here. People who grew up in Baltimore, do you know the word stoop? We have stoop storytelling, you know. I've heard, I know in East Baltimore, Highland Town, I've heard people say we were sitting out on the stoop. Maybe that's a bygone thing. Maybe it never was.
Or maybe it changed by neighborhood by neighborhood. That would be interesting.
Might be the case. You might hear stoop in Highland Town. Stoop to me is the platform right outside the vestibule, right outside the front door of your row house.
We need an architect.
Yeah. So I need a real Baltimorean to call in and tell me that, because I've heard other people say this, that we don't call it stoop, but I don't think that's true. I think some people use the word stoop, and some people use the word steps, refer to marble steps. But anyway, I'd like to get some clarification on that from a native. 410-662-8780. How about Maria in Randallstown? Maria, welcome to Midday.
Yeah, hello, Dan. I live in Baltimore County for 34 years. I came from ex-Soviet Union, and I like Baltimore because Baltimore has very rich cultural life. We have wonderful Baltimore Symphony. We have opera. Nabucco will be on May 9 and 11. We have the best crab cakes in the United States. I travel in the United States, but the best crab cake only in Maryland. We have a beautiful Inner Harbor. What started to build when I came to this country, it was empty. And now we have a wonderful place to go. And we live 1 hour from Washington, D.C. We live 2 hours from Philadelphia, who has also a great cultural life. We live 3 hours from New York. What can be best? Such, when you live in Baltimore, you have everything the best what can this country can offer.
Well, thank you, Maria. Thank you very much. How do you like that?
Well, and she brings up an important point that we shouldn't overlook, is that the housing stock had deteriorated and something had to replace it. So that's the reality of it.
What's up, Dan? This is from Jermaine. Oh, Jermaine that I happen to know. Jermaine, it says, been a long time since I saw you. Anyway, I love the Baltimore art scene. Jermaine is a great piano player. Mm. Love the Baltimore art scene. The jazz is great, but I just wish there was more of it. Another thing is this. No other state can make good seafood. I can't even get a good fish sub. In fact, in some states, I'd be lucky to see any fish subs. Some sub shops don't even know what hots are. Thank you very much. It's really interesting comments coming in here. Artscape is the premier Baltimore festival, writes Michael, and I always look forward to it. There you go. It's another thing to brag about to out-of-towners, to get them to come here during Artscape time. Here are a few of the Baltimore idiosyncrasies that I have noticed. In West Baltimore, where I did social work, I always heard Doug, meaning dog, go get the Doug. And this may be more of something related to the differences between Southeast and... I don't know what these initials mean. I'm sorry, I don't know what that means, so I can't read it. Please don't use abbreviations when you write emails.
Well, he's saying that there are regional differences within the city, and it's interesting because...
Do you know that that's what that means?
Well, Doug versus dog?
Okay, yeah, but I didn't get the rest of it.
Oh, okay.
I'm sorry, I got stumped in the middle of a sentence there. I apologize. I can't figure that one out. Carl in Baltimore, we'll go to you next. Oh, no, not Carl, I'm sorry. Stephanie in Baltimore. Stephanie, please.
I was calling about the comment about stoop.
Yeah, thank you, Stephanie.
In Baltimore City, stoop is definitely a word. My great-grandmother lived in the 2400 block of North Avenue, and I hung out there in the summers, and you sat on the stoop. You played on the stoop. You made up stoop games. In Baltimore City, there's definitely a stoop.
Stephanie, thank you very much. Way to go. And Susan in Owings Mills. Was going to back us up again.
I was born and raised here. I haven't lived my whole life here, but I was born and raised here. And I never heard stoop growing up. I didn't live in the city, though. But I hear it now. And I also wanted to say I agree with Germaine. I've lived all over the country, and nobody can offer me anything in shellfish, not after being in Baltimore.
Mm-hmm. Okay, I'm with you on that. I grew up with fried clams, you know, steamers. Steamers in New England, so
yeah.
I miss those. But she's right. Well, and I can get those here. I know how to get those here.
Yeah, yeah.
I know who to call.
And you have yet to share that with me.
That's right. I owe you a visit to Lexington Market
for fried
clams at the Crab Pot.
Right. Because I was about to say, I don't eat fried clams unless I'm in New England, and I don't eat crab cakes unless I'm here.
Right. 410-662-8780 is our phone number here if you'd like to join us. Back to homogenization and that whole thing. So that is a phenomenon, but it's not wiping away regional culture, regional identity in the United States.
Well, I think we have to be conscious of it. And I think that's one of the reasons that we did the show. We wanted to call attention to the fact that if this is something we value, we have to preserve it. And nobody's mentioned painted screens yet, so we have to bring that in.
Painted screens, another iconic Baltimore thing. Who are we going to next? I'm sorry, Sophie in Pikesville. Sophie, sorry to keep you holding there.
Hi, Erhan. How you doing?
Good, Soph.
I grew up in South Baltimore.
Mm-hmm.
And I had two older brothers who became professional speakers. And one was in a dramatic group, and I was helping him rehearse for a play one time, and we had a little recorder. And I decided to tape my voice, and when I heard what I sounded like as a teenager, I was appalled. It was so Balmore-y's. And we lived and grew up in an industrial neighborhood, a lot of people from Appalachia, from the South, and so on. And I thought the Balmore-y's accent was not very charming. We looked at it as the time went by as people, uneducated people.
Mm.
And I worked as a volunteer at the visitor center, and I recall the wharves, the Old Bay Line, and the rotten wooden wharves with rat infested.
At the Inner Harbor, you mean?
And the Inner Harbor.
Yeah.
And I was so happy to see all the improvements and changes taking place that I think the Old Balmore is it's history, but I don't miss it.
That's a very interesting comment. And you didn't have that feeling about how you spoke until you actually heard yourself in a recording.
Exactly. Yeah. Exactly.
That's interesting. What to say about that? People are self-conscious of that.
We hear ourselves differently when we're listening to a recording. Mm-hmm. I mean, I sound different. I've heard a lot of recordings of me, and I sound different than I sound to me.
Yeah, but she's speaking specifically about this Balmer accent that we all are aware of. You know it when you hear it, but she associates it with something negative.
Well, and I think it's the recording aspect of it, is that her standard for a recorded voice is Walter Cronkite.
Right. Or what she hears on radio or television.
Yeah, I think that's
part of that homogenizational process, right?
Yes. Yes.
And Sabrine in Gwin Oak, giving us a ring on this idea of stoop versus steps. Hi, Sabrine.
Hi. I'm calling because where I grew up, they were called steps. Where my grandmother grew up, they were called stoops.
Oh, where'd your grandmother grow up?
Down in the middle of Baltimore, downtown in near Pine Street Station.
Oh, okay. Well, thank you very much.
Stoops, and people in East Baltimore call them stoops.
Yep.
And other neighborhoods, I think it goes by neighborhood.
I think you're right.
There's a study there.
All right. Well, we didn't solve all the problems of the world in this hour, did we?
No,
but
not
I think
yet.
We had an interesting conversation. Yeah. I appreciate you coming in to be part of it. Sherry Parks from the University of Maryland, Associate Dean in Arts and Humanities, who joins us once a month to talk about cultural things here on Midday on Culture. Thank you, Sherry.
Thank you.
Yeah, so have a great rest of the week, a great weekend. Everybody will be back for Midday Friday tomorrow at noon, starting at noon, like usual. Thank you for tuning in. Dan Rodericks for our staff here. Have a great afternoon.
Is Nikki Gamer. The producer and director is Jonathan Ahrens. The associate producer, Michael Himowitz. Our interns are James Daly, Tom Cartaxo, and Michelle Richardson. Music produced by Jeff Truman in High Gravity Sounds. Midday podcast and live streaming available at wypr.org. Dan Rodrick's column appears in the Baltimore Sun. This is WYPR, your NPR news station.